American troops, along with an interpreter, were just killed in Syria, raising questions about why U.S. forces are still there.
These troops are in Syria without any clear legal mandate. They're there without any clear or defined or achievable mission.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, the American military in Syria. Also, electric vehicle makers from China are shaping the global market for cars.
I think there's a real question of whether Western automakers can compete or wish to compete.
Plus, what it feels like to be watched 24/7 by a sophisticated surveillance software.
There is no privacy. There is no safe space where I can just be left alone.
We'll hear all about the company that's behind this powerful spy tool today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. In Australia, officials say the deadly attack at Bondi Beach in Sydney was inspired by the so-called Islamic State. According to police, the two suspects traveled to an island in the Philippines where ISIS-linked insurgents are known to operate.
More details are emerging today after another ISIS-linked attack over the weekend, this one against American forces in Syria. Two U.S. service members were killed, along with their interpreter. Three others were wounded.
This was the first deadly attack on American troops in Syria since the fall of Bashar al-Assad a year ago. It's also a reminder of the dangers they still face. The World's Shireen Jafari starts our coverage today.
At first, the U.S. military did not release the names of the soldiers who were killed. That's protocol. They're released only after the next of kin has been notified. They were members of the Iowa National Guard. Lene Strover, president of the organization Final Salute, spoke with the local WHO 13 in Iowa.
There was a time frame where no family in Iowa knew if it was their son or daughter. And what a heart-wrenching few hours that every family is sitting there just praying that that door does not have, that doesn't knock, that they open it and they see those people on the other side of the door.
Yesterday, the names of the soldiers were released. 25-year-old Sergeant Edgar Brian Torres Tovar, 29-year-old Sergeant William Nathaniel Howard. Both were deployed to Syria in May, according to officials. They, along with their interpreter, were killed in an ambush near Palmyra in central Syria. The place is known for its iconic Roman-era ruins. But there's a vast desert in that part of Syria, which is ungoverned. Bassam Barabandi is a political analyst in Damascus.
It's easy to hide and easy to get lost. There's no cities, there's no villages, there's nothing. And that's why ISIS sleeping cells, they use it.
Sleeper cells are groups that remain inactive for a while but carry out sudden attacks. Barabandi says the Syrian government has arrested five suspects. The attacker, who was killed on the spot, was a member of the Syrian security forces. He was able to infiltrate a meeting between the Syrian forces and a delegation from the International Coalition Forces. They were there to discuss ways to combat ISIS, officials said. The deaths of these service members is a test for the government of Ahmad al-Sharqa and its powerful backer, the U.S.
It's a very new relation with the United States. So even the relation with the United States, the protocol of dealing with the United States, it's new for them. So I think this is the area where they are rediscovering or discovering themselves. How can we go forward on that?
Barabandi says Syria needs the U.S. to help it rebuild and reconstruct. That's why it's taking the attack over the weekend seriously, launching an investigation and making arrests. The so-called Islamic State hasn't taken responsibility for the attack. That's not unusual. But the U.S. president and the Department of Defense say the attacker was an ISIS member. The DOD, the Army, and the Central Command did not give me any more details about the attack. Colin Clark, executive director of the Soufan Center, says what happened over the weekend reminds him of Afghanistan, where sometimes members of the Afghan army targeted U.S. forces.
That was something that was almost the last straw when it came to the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Islamic State in Syria has a similar strategy. They want to push the United States out so they can have more room to grow, to recruit, and to gain operational maneuver.
The U.S. has roughly 1,000 troops stationed in Syria, mainly in the northeast and south. They were initially deployed under the Obama administration to fight ISIS. By 2019, the group was defeated, but the Americans stayed to fight any remaining insurgents. Clark says despite the continued threats to American forces, they should remain in the country.
My concern is that with the U.S. so preoccupied with a rising China, Russia's war in Ukraine, everything that's been happening in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas, that, you know, we've taken our eye off the ball when it comes to the Islamic State.
But others like John Hoffman questioned the reasoning behind the presence of American troops in Syria. Hoffman is a research fellow at the Cato Institute.
This is a classic example of how American families have to shoulder the costs of the failed war on terror. And it's very difficult to look at this and argue that what transpired in Syria is in any way, shape, or form America first.
Hoffman says ISIS is not an existential threat to the U.S. Homicide rates in the States far outnumber deaths from ISIS attacks, he adds.
These troops are in Syria without any clear legal mandate. They're there without any clear or defined or achievable mission. And this is the time that for Trump to focus on bringing U.S. troops home from Syria.
An official at the Pentagon told me that there are currently no plans to change the number of American forces in the region. Yesterday, President Trump responded to a reporter who asked why there are American forces in Syria.
Because we're trying to make sure that there's going to be and remain peace in the Middle East, and Syria is a big part of it.
Trump also said that there will be, quote, serious retaliation against those responsible for killing American forces. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The European Union set an ambitious goal a few years ago for getting rid of gas-powered vehicles. It would effectively ban the sale of new combustion engine cars in 2035. Today, the EU revealed it is likely to backtrack on that plan and allow the sale of some non-electric vehicles past that deadline. To learn more, we reached out to Ilaria Matsako, who focuses on energy and sustainability at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She told me the EU isn't reversing course on electric vehicles, just softening its goals for EVs.
What they're saying is that some plug-in hybrids can continue to be sold and some other vehicles as well, as long as the manufacturers meet some other sustainability goals, right? Linked to the use of green steel that's made in Europe or, you know, alternative fuels, etc.
And why is the EU backtracking on its goal or softening it, as you say?
Well, there's been a lot of pushback on the part of manufacturers that have complained that demand is not as strong as it was, and also that effectively, by having such strict measures, the EU was giving a privilege to Chinese manufacturers that are super competitive in this area. And so that might undermine production in Europe. And so I think there's been a lot of concerns about the sort of geopolitical and economic and trade implications of these climate goals.
So Chinese manufacturers are what, exclusively or mostly making EVs? So European manufacturers want to be able to retain their market share on traditional engines?
No, I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case, but it's easier to make profits on internal combustion engine vehicles. So car makers have been very hesitant, traditional car makers have been very hesitant to shift to a full EV strategy because it's hard to make as much profits. But at the same time, there's also certainly, I think, just, you know, that car makers are hesitant to delve into a new, embrace a new technology that's completely different from what they've been making for, you know, in some cases over 100 years.
And you said that car manufacturers in Europe were arguing that demand is slowing. Is there truth to that? What are the numbers of EV car sales in Europe look like?
At the moment, EV sales in the European Union are well over 20%, over twice as much as the percentage in the United States. Some markets are doing really strongly, some are doing less strongly. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of variation there.
You mentioned the U.S. How do EV sales in Europe compare to other parts of the world?
China, which has done extraordinarily well, over 50% of new car sales are electric vehicles. And that includes, you know, pure electric and plug-in hybrids, by the way. But in other countries, it's certainly much lower. Certainly Japan is very, very low, for example. Norway is close to reaching full sales of cars being electric. And several other Scandinavian countries do extremely well. When you look at Southern Europe, it looks a little less rosy. Although numbers and sales are increasing, it's just not as high as in Northern Europe.
I was also reading a report from the think tank Ember saying that sales for EVs was really growing in developing countries, a lot of them in Asia, when you compare that to places like Europe. Can you tell me anything about that?
Yeah, I think if you look at countries like Thailand, where really nobody expected there to be really healthy EV markets, it's about the same EV sales rate as the European Union. So that's been a bit of a surprise over the past couple of years. We've seen a very rapid growth in these countries, largely actually thanks to Chinese exports that have made cheap and attractive EVs available to these middle-class consumers in developing countries.
The U.S. is also changing its incentives for car companies to make more electric vehicles. Do you kind of tie that in with what is happening in Europe?
I think in the U.S. we've seen a much more radical shift in policy. Many of the credits that were included in the Inflation Reduction Act have been canceled, and the regulation on tailpipe emissions has been also changed dramatically. And so I think we've seen like a very much a rollback in the United States.
So if I were to ask you about the global transition to electric vehicles, it sounds like there are different trajectories in different parts of the world, but how would you characterize globally what is happening?
Globally, it's clear that this connected electric vehicle mix is extremely powerful and is going to be extremely attractive across multiple markets. It's clear that also the pace at which it's going to be adopted is going to be very different. I would expect it's going to be much, much slower in the United States and North America. It's going to be, I think, faster in the European Union as a whole, and I think even faster in places like China. And I think, you know, Chinese automakers are going to be increasingly going global and expanding in emerging markets, providing that Chinese technological package. And I think there's a real question of whether Western automakers can compete or wish to compete.
Before I let you go, what do you think the EV market looks like in, say, 5 years from now?
I think we'll be seeing a lot more of them across the world, although probably not as many in the United States as in some developing countries. So that's going to be really surprising, right? That's not what any of us expected 10 years ago.
Ilaria Matsako is Deputy Director and Senior Fellow for Chinese Business and Economics in the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
We've got an update on a story we reported last week about a controversial real estate project in Serbia's capital, Belgrade.
The Serbian government had signed a 99-year lease agreement with a group linked to Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law. Kushner's company was planning to finance a $500 million high-rise. It would have included a hotel, luxury apartments, and commercial space. The project won the backing of Serbia's government, but it met with some fierce opposition.
If I could give advice to Jared Kushner and his company.
This is cultural heritage expert Snezhka Kvaflik Mihailovic speaking to The World earlier this month.
I would say that they definitely should not want to be part of a scheme that is so blatantly based on the violation of the Constitution and the rule of law. And that cannot be the healthy basis for developing good relationship between Serbia and the United States.
That advice seems prescient now because prosecutors in Serbia have charged a government minister with abuse of office and falsifying documents in an apparent attempt to pave the way for Kushner's real estate project. That's according to a statement from the Public Prosecutor's Office for Organized Crime.
The building site for the high-rise in Belgrade is a protected cultural heritage zone. Prosecutors say government officials forged documents to illegally remove that designation. Our reporting lays out other reasons why this building project is so controversial. Learn more at theworld.org.
After 30 years, understanding a ferry disaster that claimed hundreds of lives and traumatized a newly independent country. We have that story from Estonia just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It was right up there with the Titanic as one of the worst maritime disasters in modern history. The MS Estonia was a ferry boat for cars and passengers. When it sank in the Baltic Sea in 1994, more than 800 passengers and crew lost their lives. A joint investigation by Estonia, Finland, and Sweden has tried to explain the disaster and disprove some theories as well. This week, after three decades of work, investigators say a structural issue with the bow of the ship caused the disaster of the MS Estonia. Christian Talbri is a professor of marine technology at the Tallinn University of Technology in Estonia. His research helped investigators reach this week's conclusions.
The vessel was on its normal route from the capital of Estonia, Tallinn, to the Stockholm, that is the capital of Sweden. The weather conditions were quite heavy. Nothing extreme, but still very heavy condition. And also the wind direction was, and thus also the wave direction was not really good for the vessel. The waves were coming slightly from the port side and the ship was sailing into the waves. And in some point, the locks of the bow visor failed and the bow visor actually became detached from the ship. It also took with it the car ramp, which in that ship was acting as a collision bulkhead. So basically, it should have remained to the ship to prevent the water from entering once the visor has been lost. Once the bow ramp was completely open, the bow ramp is basically the ramp from which the cars entered the vessel.
Right.
And of course, it left a big opening and then the water could come into the ship, into very large car deck. And with the water on the car deck, you are already in a very bad situation.
So of the 1,000 some odd people aboard, 800 were lost. Why was the death toll so high?
Because it sank quite quickly. It didn't take that long time to sink. And it was in the middle of quite open sea and in the middle of the night with heavy weather conditions. So one reason was, of course, that the help didn't get there in time. The first to react were the other passenger ships in the region, but it took a long time to get there. Of course, you have extremely cold weather. At that time, you have very heavy waves.
Right.
And you can imagine that if your ship rolls 90 degrees, the stairs, what you had to use to climb out from the ship, they become walls. So it's very hard to get out from the ship when it's already rolled or heeled to a large angles.
Yeah, absolutely terrifying for those aboard. Now, you were only 15 years old at the time, Christian, but this terrible event left quite an impact on Estonia and affected you personally, I understand.
Yes, my cousin was also on the ship and she didn't make it out.
I'm so sorry.
Yes.
With this latest report that the sinking of the ship was caused by structural damage to the bow, a lot of research went into this, including a lot of models of the ship and the sinking. Can you tell us about the research and what was undertaken?
So we have really a lot of evidence. We have very detailed models of the sea bottom, where there is a hard bedrock, where there is a softer seabed. So we have really a lot of information to model such process. And what our simulations really show that with contemporary tools, we can really reproduce such extremely complex physical processes which are involved with such accident.
Christian, I'm curious to know what are some examples of alternative theories to what happened to the MS Estonia you and investigators were actually aiming to debunk.
I would say the main stories are, one story obviously is that it was purposefully, the vessel was purposefully sank because there were claims that it was involved in illegal transportation of military equipment. And I think it was also proven that the military equipment was transported with this vessel. But if you think 1994, a country which has just gained its independence from Soviet Union, there was so much military equipment everywhere. So probably some of them was actually illegally transported with this ship as well. This was one of the theory. And then also that whether it was collision with some submarine, whether it was an explosion made purposefully. So these were basically the conspiracies, what have been around there for a while. And what our investigation mainly focused was, let's see whether this accident could occur under the laws of physics without any external disturbance or purposeful actions, either from outside or from inside the vessel.
Mm. Why do you think those alternate theories actually even existed?
I think it's with every bigger accident, probably there are those alternative theories. I think it's just a human nature, because those theories are much more interesting than the actual story. And of course, you're also very young country, so you're not sure whom you can trust and who's playing what game. So I think that's the reason. The times were quite confusing at that time. We were just kind of developing or reborn as a state. So times were confusing, and I think this is also very fruitful ground for that kind of theories.
As you said, you've got family who were lost in this wreck. How did this event impact Estonia, the country, and how has it continued to sit in the country's national consciousness?
For Estonia, it really was kind of a deep trauma, because it happened really to a small, newly independent nation at the moment of quite high vulnerability. I would say the country was trying to survive, and now you have a major accident, suddenly what you have to deal. You also, even your institutions are not in place to deal with that. And I'm not talking only about rescue services, but also, let's say, accident investigation bureaus and institutions like that. We were just taking first steps as a re-independent country, so it was so major deal for us.
Kristjan Talbri is a professor of marine technology at the Tallinn University of Technology in Estonia, explaining the 1994 shipwreck of the MS Estonia that claimed more than 800 lives.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed, starting in interstellar space. A comet is making its final and closest pass by planet Earth this week. It's named 3I Atlas and was first spotted over the summer. The comet will pass within 167 million miles of Earth on Friday, so close, before heading back out into deep space. That will give backyard astronomers one last chance for a peek.
Egypt has unveiled two massive statues in the southern city of Luxor. They depict Amenhotep III, a pharaoh who ruled Egypt about 3,400 years ago. The statues were first built for his funerary temple and were later toppled by an earthquake. Now, after a 20-year effort, they've been reassembled by archaeologists.
Going even further back in time, scientists in Britain say ancient humans may have learned how to make fire much earlier than previously believed. That's after discovering evidence of controlled fires at a Paleolithic site in England, estimated to be about 400,000 years old. The previous oldest evidence from northern France only goes back about 50,000 years.
And that'll do it for a few things you might have missed. Just ahead, we continue our investigative look at surveillance software that's tracking the phones of regular people. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. This week, we're hearing about a little-known and previously secret global surveillance software and the company that makes it. We've learned that the software was used to spy on an Italian reporter as he was releasing a book about corruption inside the Vatican.
Others were also spied on, well-known figures like actor Jared Leto, the Prime Minister of Qatar, and Eric Prince, who founded Blackwater Security. But reporters looking into the software also came across seemingly random people whose movements were being tracked.
The investigation was led by Gabe Geiger, a journalist with Lighthouse Reports, along with the radio program Reveal. Reveal's Michael Montgomery explains.
Gabe learned that lots of regular people were being tracked, like a teacher, a driver, even a softball coach in Hawaii.
And we have no idea why. You can understand why a journalist investigating the Vatican is being tracked. It's not good, obviously, but you can understand why it happens, the motivation behind it. But why is a therapist inside there? That's a bigger mystery.
One phone number had a British country code, and they traced it to a person we're going to call Sophia.
Hi, Gabriel.
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm all right.
Sophia is a Russian woman who fled the country in the late 90s and eventually ended up in the UK, where she worked in the corporate sector for many years.
The first WAP data showed that Sophia was tracked for almost a year without her knowledge or consent. Sophia learned she was monitored in Britain and even on her travels abroad.
I could recognize the place where I stayed, the hotel, the restaurants area, the beach. So disturbing, quite accurate and disturbing.
All of these searches put her in the top 10% of all the phone numbers that Lighthouse analyzed. Sophia asked that we not use her real name out of concern for retaliation, but she wanted her voice heard.
This needs to be shared as widely as possible for people to be aware that dangers like this are lurking just around the corner.
At the time she was tracked, Sophia was working in a highly competitive industry that put a premium on new patents. As a company executive, she had access to all kinds of confidential information.
I thought, well, most likely it was a competitor. And then I thought, oh my gosh, maybe it was actually my own company, because I've read stories of the companies also spying on their employees. And then a less likely but plausible scenario, maybe I have been surveilled by a Russian state because I have been a fairly vocal critic of the inhumane policies of the Russian government in my own humble ways.
To figure out who was behind the tracking, Gabe went back into the data where he noticed something unusual.
Which is that her phone number is being tracked at the same time as a bunch of Pakistani phone numbers.
Sophia recalled knowing only one person from Pakistan while she was living in Britain. He was an instructor her company had hired to help her get a driver's license.
He had to sometimes meet me and pick me up at my home, and we would have to drive all the way to the office together. So he already knew where I worked. He knew where I lived.
Sophia says the man regaled her with stories about his time in the army and about his connections to Pakistani intelligence agencies.
He was quite keen to stay in touch with me. And over time, he started to pursue me romantically.
Something about this guy felt off. Sophia definitely wasn't interested, so she broke off contact. But for months, the man kept calling and texting. Years later, after speaking with Lighthouse reports, Sophia learned something important. The man wasn't just a driving instructor. He was also a sales manager for a private security company. It seems somehow he got access to Altimedes and used it to track Sophia and several of his colleagues.
This software became a sort of plaything of some people who had access to it, and they used it to track people they were romantically pursuing or harassing. They used it to track their wives. They used it to track their kids. They used it to track the people their kids were dating.
It's really alarming and disturbing how easy it is to use this type of technology.
The unwanted calls and texts eventually stopped. But since learning about the man who was secretly surveilling her, Sophia says she's been asking herself a lot of questions. How do you build relationships with people, and how do you maintain them?
It makes me definitely rethink how to deal with people, you know, without turning into a paranoid or a bitter person. It sort of put my own perceptions of safety upside down. Like there is no privacy, there is no safe space where I can just be left alone.
When you think about it, it's kind of amazing that this massive data set that Gabe stumbled on would include a journalist covering corruption in the Vatican and just a regular person like Sophia. The Lighthouse Report's investigation continued, and Gabe says they figured out one way to make sense of the mobile numbers in the data set. Look for patterns or clusters.
We're talking about groups of numbers that are related to each other. So maybe every day these two numbers are being tracked within 1 minute of each other. Or they can be connected in terms of place. So these two numbers are being tracked in the same building, or they're being tracked, 100 feet away from each other.
That's how they came upon a trail of South African phone numbers.
And we can notice that they're all being tracked at the same time. This tracking is highly correlated. We start digging in further and we realize that these aren't South Africans. We see that they're actually Rwandans in exile living in South Africa.
Turns out some of the numbers were connected to an opposition movement called the Rwanda National Congress that was actively campaigning for a more democratic government
The movement was gaining momentum when one of its leaders was found strangled in a hotel room in Johannesburg.
A former head of the Rwanda External Intelligence Service has been found murdered in a hotel in South Africa, the country where he has been living in exile for several years.
The man's name was Patrick Karegeya. He was a rebel fighter who became Rwanda's foreign intelligence chief after the genocide in 1994. He was a close ally of President Paul Kagame, but the two had a bitter falling out. As a result, Patrick was imprisoned and then went into exile. Here's Patrick talking about the dangers he and his comrades faced.
Some have died, some are in prison, others are in exile like us, and it will continue.
Even in exile, Patrick says he knew they were being targeted by the Rwandan government.
That's why my colleague got shot. I probably was a bit lucky I went off without a scar.
Still, he continued to speak out against Kagame. And for that, he was branded an enemy of the state.
There's been a wealth of reporting that's sort of shown how Kagame's regime was incredibly paranoid about potential opposition to his government. And it's been well documented that Kagame has set up a sort of intelligence apparatus that tracks and hunts down dissidents abroad.
Patrick believed he was a marked man, but he would make light of it using his dry sense of humor. This is Patrick's daughter, Portia.
He used to joke in a way that I didn't enjoy that he was a dead man walking, in verbatim.
Journalist and author Michaela Wrong knew Patrick and also remembers his dark sense of humor. She wrote a book about him and his murder called Do Not Disturb. In it, she writes about how Patrick would joke about Rwanda's intelligence operations.
Patrick Karegeya used to joke, hey, you know, you think they're James Bond, but I was James Bond. I'm the spy chief. You know how this stuff works. I'm ahead of the game. And he was more vulnerable than he realized, and events proved that to be the case.
The Lighthouse team wanted to know if there was any connection between Patrick's killing in 2013 and the tracking of people around him before his death. They knew one thing. Patrick's phone number didn't show up in the cluster. But they uncovered the identities of others, including a man named Jack Nziza, and shared them with Michaela Wrong.
If you follow Rwanda closely, or even if you don't follow it closely at all, Jack Nziza is infamous. He's been associated really throughout his career with top-level assassination. I mean, people sort of shudder when they mention his name.
Michaela recognized a second person who showed up in the cluster, the wife of an opposition figure who worked closely with Patrick, and a third, Patrick's bodyguard and driver.
So you've got the wife of one dissident, the bodyguard and driver of another, and a man who is associated with top-level hits.
Those clusters that Gabe and the Lighthouse team found are known as relational targeting in the world of surveillance technology. It's a concept that's very familiar to Ron Diebert from Citizen Lab.
You have a principal target in mind, and you want to gather as much information about that target as possible. But you might have difficulty, for example, hacking their device because they put in place all sorts of defense mechanisms.
This is where relational targeting comes into play. You track people whose movements mirror those of your targets.
So you get at their daughter, their son, their cousin, their uncle, or whatever, and you track them collaterally. We see it in just about every case that we investigate.
You know, you can't kill someone if you don't know where they are. You can't kill people if you don't have real-time intelligence showing you their locations.
As a former officer in the Rwandan army, Robert Higiro had organized sensitive military operations where intelligence gathering was crucial. Robert was also living in exile and was close to Patrick. He says he knew the government wanted to kill his friend, but he didn't know someone was using FirstWAP's software, Altimedes, to track people close to him. Learning about it today, he's not surprised.
They do these things, they choose these methods of eliminating people by killing in cold blood because of they want to terrorize the population.
The tracking stopped months before Patrick's murder, and it's unclear if other people close to him were being monitored at the time of his death. Portia was in Canada when she got word that her father was dead. It was New Year's Day, 2014.
Even when I used to visit and say goodbye, you would always wonder, is that the last time I say goodbye to my dad? And then that he actually ultimately is killed. You know, I just remember thinking, okay, so the world is just chaos and people are awful and there's not much you personally can do to get away from that. And it is absolutely a part of your life and your story.
The Rwandan government was widely suspected of ordering Patrick's killing. And arrest warrants were issued for two Rwandan men, but there's never been a trial. Portia says her father's murder had the intended effect of splintering the opposition movement.
There's a certain something that happens when you feel like you've lost good people. And so I think folks just didn't quite know how to stay together in the same way.
It remains a mystery who had access to the first WAP software that was used to track people close to Patrick Karegeya. A representative from the Rwandan embassy in Washington said the government of Rwanda, quote, has never had nor sought to have such software, directly or indirectly. In response to this investigation, First WAP denied it was involved in any human rights violations. The company also said it couldn't address specific allegations because of client confidentiality. There is other evidence showing how the company and its executives have been connected to a list of governments with poor human rights records, such as emails, interviews with former employees, and the original data that Gabe collected. According to that data, First WAP founder Joseph Fuchs visited more than 25 countries between 2007 and 2015.
One of the unique things that you see in this data set is that Fuchs and other company executives are tracking their own phone numbers hundreds of thousands of times as they crisscross the globe.
Lighthouse Reports suspects that Fuchs and other First WAP executives traveled to many of these places while drumming up business for Altamedes.
And what kind of ties a lot of them together is that, one, they're authoritarian, and two, they have a history of abusing surveillance tech against their own citizens.
Like Thailand in 2013, Fuchs is there just as anti-government protests surge.
We see Fuchs tracking his phone number and other Thai phone numbers. You know, maybe this is a way for him to show off how the software is working. But in any case, right after that, we see a huge uptick in activity in Thailand.
Gabe says hundreds of Thai phone numbers were monitored with Altamedes just as the authorities stepped up a brutal crackdown. According to documents and interviews with former employees, Lighthouse learned that Altamedes customers included the governments of Belarus, Indonesia, Malaysia, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, and Uzbekistan.
This is essentially despotism as a service.
Ron Diebert from Citizen Lab says working with repressive governments is a common feature throughout the surveillance industry.
These are companies that are facilitating human rights abuses and some pretty horrible, egregious practices. So we're dealing with the facilitation through this service of transnational authoritarianism.
This is just probably a small sliver of the company's total activities. It's clearly not the entire set. And we don't have activities from, you know, 2015 onwards. So what happened after that point? Yeah, that keeps me up at night.
In a statement, First WAP said it had not offered or sold its products to repressive regimes. And it noted that it had no knowledge of any discussions or presentations that may have been carried out by the company's founder, Joseph Fuchs. Fuchs died in 2024.
Michael Montgomery there from the radio program Reveal. Tomorrow, a face-to-face with First WAP as an undercover South African business broker looks to buy Altamedes.
We intentionally designed him to be very shady. He's working for unnamed governments, private clients, a bunch of red flags that anybody who's doing serious due diligence would pick up on.
Catch the third and final installment in our series tomorrow. Here at The World, we're getting ready to celebrate the new year and also a big birthday.
The show is about to turn 30.
Yep, 30 years on the air as of this New Year's Day. Be sure to tune in on January 1st as we swing back through three decades of news, music, and our favorite game, the GeoQuiz.
Until then, we want to hear from you. What does The World, our program, not the whole planet, mean to you? Head to our website, theworld.org, and click on the link in the banner.
Your notes will help propel us into 2026, and we might even share your comments on the air. So show your support by telling us what you love about The World.
We couldn't do it without you. Again, that's theworld.org. And thank you, as always, for listening. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The holidays are upon us, which means get baking. Even those of you who rarely fire up the oven might be making a batch of cookies or a pie from an old family recipe. For some baking inspiration, we reached out to writer and baker Laurel Kratochwila. Her newest cookbook is called Dobre Dobre, Baking from Poland and Beyond. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome, Laurel.
Thank you for having me.
So you start your book with a quote that I would also like to start this interview with. You write, "I fell in love with Polish baking because I didn't like the pickles in the Czech Republic." Please explain.
So what do pickles have to do with Polish baking? Well, about 18 years ago, I found myself living in the Czech Republic, and I was so disappointed to find that the pickles in the Czech Republic are sweet. And I've been hoping for some real sour pickles, you know, Central Eastern Europe, this is like the land of pickles. And I started dating a guy. I think it was our second date. He said, "Well, if you don't like the pickles here, let me take you to Poland." And it seemed like such a ludicrous idea, but it was really about, I don't know, an hour and a half drive. We get to the other side. We were near this town called Jelenia Góra. First fruit and vegetable stand we saw, we just pulled over, and they sell loose pickles. And I was so happy. And then I saw a bakery, and we had to go into the bakery. And in the bakery, I was so surprised to see just like a shelf full of challah. I recognized this. It was like being home, you know, being in like a good Jewish bakery in New England or New York. And I think that was my first moment of, aha, this is the country where I find the food that's familiar to me, that I love, that touches upon nostalgia, because I really felt at home through that experience.
You wrote that the challah tasted like the challah that you grew up on. You are Jewish. You have Polish heritage. I'm curious kind of like why this surprised you, I guess, that this existed in Poland.
What surprised me about it is that it was in a context that was not Jewish, right? So you would find challah in a Jewish bakery. I mean, you could get it in a grocery store, of course, but it is a Jewish bread. And here I was in rural Poland, no Jews in this region for who knows how long, and there's challah. And I think that is what made it exciting and surprising to me, and just kind of opened a little Pandora's box that made me want to look more.
So I think it's high time that we talk some recipes. Hannah's apple cake, the recipe for that is on our website, theworld.org. Can you tell me the story behind that recipe?
Hannah's apple cake. So first of all, there's 10 recipes in the book that are contributed from other bakers, both in Poland and of Polish or Polish Jewish origin around the world. And Hannah's one of them. She's based in London. But this is her grandmother's apple cake, and it started in Lublin. That's where her grandmother was born. It was a family recipe and spans the whole 20th century, right? Because first they left Lublin as economic migrants to Vienna, and then Kristallnacht happened, right? And they moved to, I believe it was Paris, and then Casablanca. And then all the way South America, they were in Montevideo, they moved to Texas. And finally, you know, we're talking three generations later, Hannah lives in London And her grandmother passed down this recipe for her when she was hosting her first Rosh Hashanah. It's this wonderfully kind of dense, very moist in the middle, very sugary, crusty, crunchy on the outside. Mm. It's a unique texture.
You're making me hungry.
Maybe this is the first one you'll make out of the book, but it's such a good example of the diasporic nature mm-hmm. of Polish baking and how it's moved around the world and changed a little as it's gone, right? So her grandmother would have just used regular oil in this, whereas Hannah changed it up a little, modernized it a bit, and she uses olive oil and brown sugar. And it just gives it this little extra something. Yet at its essence, it's the recipe from Lublin. Mm.
Yeah, other recipes in your book have stories like this one, recipes being passed down, crossing borders, being tweaked. I'm wondering mm-hmm. if there are, you know, kind of the fingerprints of that movement in any of the other recipes, ingredient changes, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I played around with a few recipes. You know, I have very updated bialy with a horseradish cream and spring vegetables. And then also there is a chef in Melbourne who works in the fine dining world. His name is Zachary Leon First. And what he likes to do is take like a classical Polish recipe, very often things that his grandparents made, and adapt it for that fine dining environment. Mm. So he has this very elegant honey cake with a raisin jam and a honey cream that we have in the book. So that's an example of the changes and the adaptations that recipes are taking on these days.
Before I let you go, I did want to ask about the title of your cookbook, Dobre Dobre. What does that mean and why choose that as the title?
So Dobre Dobre means good, good. But the full phrase is Dobre Dobre Nezasłodkie, which means good, good, not too sweet. And this is a Polish compliment for a cake or a pastry. Mm. And I love it because it's a little counterintuitive to the American way of thinking, which is we want our desserts as sweet as possible. And a lot of Polish desserts, it's about letting a seasonal fruit shine or getting a bit of a sweet crunch from streusel. And so it's a bit of a different philosophy around baking. And I love that.
Me too. Love a dessert that is not too, too sweet. Laurel Krotak-Wila's recent cookbook is called Dobre Dobre, Baking from Poland and Beyond. She spoke with us earlier this fall.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find more original reporting on our YouTube channel. Look for The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening. We will be right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
From PRX.